From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber-Davis, in for April Baer. Today, as Michigan's primary wraps up, new research shows local officials are feeling confident about a smooth vote count.
And actually, the number one thing is just the cost of election administration. This isn't necessarily things going wrong with the election or worries about, you know, miscounts or anything like that. It's just the cost of staffing.
Plus, the drinking water crisis inside the Kalamazoo County Jail.
What was being told via the loved ones, via social media, of folks who were in the jail were saying they weren't getting that many bottles of water. Many of them weren't feeling like they were getting enough to drink, period.
And are Petoskey stones only in Petoskey, Michigan? One on-hand listener wanted to know, and we've got the goods for you today.
You can find Petoskeys. I've got friends that have horses north of town, and they kick them out of the pasture all the time.
All that coming up today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber-Davis, in for April Baer. Today, our on-hand podcast answers your question, can you find Petoskey stones outside of Petoskey? That's later on the program, but first, we're down to the final day before Michigan's primary voting wraps up, and according to new research from U of M's Michigan Public Policy Survey, local election officials are expecting a pretty calm, drama-free vote count this year. Stephanie Leiser is the director for the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy at U of M's Ford School, and she also teaches there. She recently spoke with April Baer. Let's listen.
You've been involved in research like this for some time now. Can I ask what makes for a smooth voting day and tabulation process?
Well, as you said, what clerks are hoping for is boring. They want people to not have to wait too long, to know what they need to do, and for everything to just go smoothly, and then the staff can proceed with the count and turning it into the county, and then everything just goes right according to plan.
Stephanie, a lot of us thought that there never would be anything but smooth voting days, and then 2020 happened. Can you talk a little bit about the kinds of problems that can come up for clerks in Michigan cities and townships when they're running elections?
Sure. This is actually something we asked about in our survey, about kind of what are the main things that they're worried about and thinking about going into this election season. And actually, the number one thing is just the cost of election administration. This isn't necessarily things going wrong with the election or worries about, you know, miscounts or anything like that. It's just the cost of staffing and, you know, having all of those early voting days available and you know, making sure that some of the reforms we've implemented to make voting easier and more accessible, that they can actually implement those. So that's honestly the main thing that clerks are really thinking about, is making sure they just have enough resources and staffing in place to make sure things go smoothly. Along with that is recruiting poll workers. That was the number two worry, but you know, that's sort of related to the cost. And then the other things that really stood out as things that clerks and local officials are worried about is, you know, sort of outside of their control is disinformation, possible disturbances at polling locations. And, you know, this is something I think we're all really grappling with because, it's hard to know what local clerks can really do about this sort of information that spreads very rapidly on social media and that sort of thing. So they're really trying to do their best to, you know, be really clear with voters. Here are the processes, the procedures, what needs to happen. But they're definitely very worried about disinformation.
What have these administrators told you in the surveys about disinformation and the role, the disruptive role that it can play?
So we do hear from about 20% of local governments, our respondents, that they're at least somewhat or significantly worried about disinformation. And that's something that has been consistently high or consistently at around that level in the past few years. So that's not going away. And then the other thing about it is that this is much more of a concern in larger jurisdictions. So when we compare our larger cities to smaller townships, about 43% of our respondents from our largest places are worried about disinformation, and about 24% of them are worried about disturbances.
Can you maybe tell us a little bit more about who you were talking to, who you were asking in this survey?
Yes. So this is a survey that we've been running regularly, actually, since 2009. And we ask typically local officials, so these are like city managers, clerks, mayors, about a wide variety of things that they're working on in communities across the state. And so we revisit this campaign set of questions that we ask, or campaign and election set of questions, when we know that there are big elections coming up and it's very much in the news. So these are questions that we asked on our spring 26 surveys, and it's kind of like, what are you anticipating? What are you worried about? How are your levels of confidence going into this election season? So we have data going back several years on this, and we've most recently asked this question this year. So we can kind of compare to 2020 if we want to, but we're asking them very general questions like, how confident are you in being able to administer an accurate and fair election? And those have been consistently quite high.
Can you tell us what the numbers look like this year? How many of our local elections officials were showing some confidence that everything was going to run smoothly?
Almost across the board, everyone's showing confidence. And we saw that 92% said they're very confident, which is the highest rating you can get. Only 1% of our respondents say, express any kind of doubt. They say maybe they don't know or are not very confident. But it's, 92% say very confident, another 7% say that they are at least somewhat confident. And that's been, like I said, that number was 87% in 2020, right? We're asking them spring 2020 as COVID is sort of turning everything upside down. So that was a little bit of a downward blip, but the number has gone up in 2022, and now in 2026, it's, to get 92% very confident is about as high as you can get on anything in survey research.
I noted that the survey results reflected that local elections administrators felt that decentralization is a strength. Can you say a little bit more about that and what that means in the context of this survey?
So decentralization, when it comes to running elections, is referring to the fact that we have all of these polling locations which are run by townships and cities, and it's not on the ground run by the state or any higher level of government. This is kind of the level of government that's closest to the residents. And Michigan is actually the state that is the most decentralized in how they run elections. So it's unusual to have all of these, small townships being, the entity, the level of government that actually administers elections. And so the reason that that's a strength is it's sort of a, it's a natural limit on how much things can go wrong. So, we hear a lot of stories and a lot of suggestions that there's going to be manipulation, that there's going to be tampering, or whatever problems that can go wrong. But in order for there to be, sort of widespread issues with our election, you'd have to have a pretty coordinated, pretty sophisticated, network of things going on at all of these different jurisdictions around the state in order to, in order to do any sort of widespread manipulation of an election. So it's very hard to imagine how that would be feasible. And so I think that's why in Michigan in particular, we should have a lot of confidence in our elections and kind of, know that those local clerks are managing what's going on in their communities, and that they're feeling very much on top of their responsibilities and their abilities to administer the elections.
I think I heard you say that since 2020, which was a really bumpy year in some parts of Michigan, that the confidence numbers have gone up, meaning to say elections officials have felt better and better since then about their ability to run this smoothly. Do we know why?
I think what's being reflected there is just the boost of confidence that comes from being able to get through 2020. And, as we said, we were asking them about in spring, right when everything was kind of falling apart, how they were feeling about elections, and they were expressing some trepidation. But as it turned out, the 2020 election went pretty smoothly for Michigan. And local clerks were able to get the job done, and there weren't too many big bumps in the road. And so I think that has sort of, well, it's like if we can administer an election in 2020, then I guess we're going to be okay. And I guess we've got the right procedures and things in place. So I think that is probably what reflects, kind of that. And really, it's just sort of a return to the level of confidence that they were at before COVID. And so they've always expressed very high confidence in the ability to administer elections.
Stephanie, this research has been done for many years, going way back before 2020. Can you tell me a little bit about why you feel it's an important measure?
So there's a number of things we think that our survey really kind of fills the gap in policy conversations around the state. One of the important things and the things we really try to emphasize is having a really high response rate. So when we run the survey, we keep pestering people until we get above 70%. I mean, pestering people, I mean that in the nicest way possible. But we really think it's important to get that breadth of response, not just from the biggest and most populous parts of the state, but from all those little townships and the clerks and all of the corners of our state, to kind of hear that on the ground report of what's really going on. How are you feeling? What are you worried about in your community? And we're really, there's really no other data source I can think of that's kind of bringing that very holistic, very widespread information into the policy conversation. And so that's why we sort of step up and ask these questions in election years, because we hear so much of the news cycle kind of focusing on, these anomalies or accusations or allegations about things that can go wrong. But we have the data that is coming in from all parts of the state. And, I mentioned that 92% confidence rating. We have the ability to break that down by region, by size of government, by even partisanship of the respondents. And it's a confidence level we really do see across the board. And so, well, everything else is partisan and people are fighting about all kinds of policy issues, Republican clerks, Democratic clerks, clerks in small townships, clerks in large cities are all kind of giving us the same message that, yep, we're ready, we're prepared, we have high confidence that we can administer this election.
Stephanie Leiser directs the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy, or CLOSUP, within Michigan's Ford School of Public Policy. Stephanie, good talking to you. Thanks.
Same to you. Thanks for having me.
After the break, a new investigative report digs into the water crisis at Kalamazoo County Jail. That story's right around the corner. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. The water in Kalamazoo County's jail is dangerously unsafe and has been for months. What comes out of the taps looks discolored, smells metallic, tastes bitter, and even causes rashes. County officials have been pushed into the spotlight and forced to address the issue. But what are officials actually doing about this? Christanity May is managing editor of Now Kalamazoo, a local news site. She's been covering the story since spring. Christanity spoke with April Baer. Here's their conversation.
Christanity, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
How did you first find out what was going on?
I first found out about the issue at the jail when the county actually issued a public notice that there were elevated levels of copper and lead in the water that they had found. A local news station would A, actually broke the story as far as, letting the public know what the county had issued in the statement. But what really caught my attention was the discrepancies between what the county was saying was not what was happening, but how the issue was being handled, and what I had seen from on Facebook post from folks who were related to or loved ones of the people in the jail.
That phrase, elevated levels of copper and lead, can mean a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
People may be aware that there is no safe level to lead exposure, no matter how small. What do you understand elevated to mean insofar as what the county has released to the public?
Yes. So I will admit that the environmental standards of water safety was not information that I had the background on reporting, but as journalists have to do, quickly understand what's happening. How I understand it is elevated copper. So, of course, copper is a natural element that is not unsafe unless there are these elevated levels, and elevated being more than what the state health department has deemed to be healthy, especially to be consuming it in your water for long periods of time. As for lead, most of the studies around lead, of course, center children and the danger there, but elevated, again, being what the state deems safe enough for someone to drink for long periods of time.
Was the county forthcoming with any data about those copper levels?
They were honest that the levels of the copper and lead in the water were more than what the state requirements for this to be in water. But when I interviewed them, they were letting me know that there was really no clear-cut answer as to what exactly the copper and lead levels were revealed to be, mainly because they said there are lots of nuances to saying this, because they get the water samples come from different areas, and so it might be elevated in one place but not the other, but that can't really speak for what each source of water in the jail would be. But what they did say is that the state safety threshold for lead is 0.012 milligrams per liter, and copper is 1.3 milligrams per liter, and that in different locations, while some were lower for copper, there were some that were above the 1.3 milligrams, and that was of more than 80 lead samples that were collected.
What were some of the symptoms that people who were at the jail were talking about, either to you or to mm-hmm. their family members who you were able to contact?
So I spoke to, on record, six people who I quoted in the story. The main thing that all of them had experienced themselves were rashes on their skin. So these are bumps and just dry areas that they were attributing to the water, because they were still using the water to shower.
Yeah. And since this all first came up, can you tell us a little bit about what the procedure has been like? I mean, how this has interfered with, I guess, the business of the jail and with the lives of people who are living there?
Mm-hmm. So you mean, like, how have they addressed the lack of unsafe water?
Yeah, what changes have been made?
So one of the first changes, of course, is what are people going to drink? Because you need water to survive. What was being told via statements through the PIO, the public information officer of the county, was that 7 to 8 bottles of water were being provided. That was what initially was told. That's actually one of the first reasons I started looking into the story, because what was being told via the loved ones, via social media, of folks who were in the jail were saying they weren't getting that many bottles of water. Many of them weren't feeling like they were getting enough to drink, period. And so with the gentlemen that I've talked to, they didn't all know each other, even though it all started with a connection from one person. They all mentioned that there was the passing out of water bottles at breakfast, lunch, and dinner, but there were many things that could happen that could lead to them not receiving a bottle of water during that time. And even though they were supposed to be able to ask for water in the meantime, in between those three periods where water was given out, that wasn't always a guarantee. It kind of just depended on if, you know, a sergeant or a CO brought the water back to you. So there was that inconsistency there. When I went back to the county to ask about how often water was being passed out, because of what the gentlemen were telling me, that's when it was corrected to be told as, yes, they're given water at these meals, and then they are offered and have the opportunity to receive water beyond that. So there's still a little bit of haziness as to if there was ever an attempt to get 7 to 8 bottles of water out. The last time I had talked to the sheriff / the PIO, or I should just say the PIO, because everything has come through statements from the PIO, they were trying to get gallon jugs so that the men could have access to more water, so that they didn't have to pass them out as frequently, because these COs are responsible for passing out tissue and all the other things that these men need. I have not been able to get the answer of if that's happened yet.
Can you tell us what you've heard from county officials about the problem overall, mm-hmm. whether they've identified the source of the problem and whether they have an immediate plan to get it resolved this year?
What's been told through the interview, the one interview I've had with the environmental health officials at the county department and through the statements from the PIO, which mostly have been statements, and through watching the county commissioners discuss this with the county administrator in public meetings, is that there's really no date that they can put on how long it will take. At least the county administrator said he's not sure how long it will take, whereas the undersheriff, I believe, Undersheriff Greenlee, has said that it could be upwards to 3 to 6 months, half a year. As far as what that looks like right now, it is inserting a filtration system, which is what is happening right now. Even with that filtration system, the latest update still showed elevated levels of copper. And I don't want to misquote the press release of lead, but still unsafe levels of contaminants in the water still, even with the new filtration system that's put in. The way they've described it is that this is something that's going to take a while because you need the orthophosphate to have time to coat the pipes to not allow the corrosion of the pipes to continue to seep and contaminate the water. So it's this long process already to fix it. But I will say that it seems that the county did quickly address the issue. As far as what we know the timeline to be, what we know the timeline to be is that there was freezing weather in around February that led to the pipes to burst. And that's when they found, you know, they had to do the testing and realized that there were these elevated levels and they needed to insert these filtration systems. However, how it's been described to me from the county health administrators as well is there's no protocol in place to test the water unless an incident happens. So that's where you see in my story, you have a man who says, I've been a plumber for a long time. And as soon as I got into the jail, I recognized things were off. And lo and behold, here comes months later and they're handing out bottles of water. So that's the timeline as I know it, when it became public, they, yes, have been addressing it. I saw the county commissioners even at a meeting put that they were holding off on other matters until they could figure out what happened at the jail. Because the story that we wrote, but also even with even though our peers in media didn't talk to as many folks in the jail as we did, they still were highlighting the crisis at this jail. And so that caused people, of course, to speak out, and that caused the county to want to respond to it and address it quickly.
Did you pick up on any reluctance within the county to either address the issue or to say definitively what was going on here?
I don't think that county officials were reluctant to say what was happening. I think always PIOs are careful to not expose too much, especially I think sometimes with the fear that they are dealing with complicated matters that people are trying to understand quickly. And so I think there's a fear that if I express too much, then it might look worse than it is. So even, for example, with elevated coppers and lead levels, when I was talking to the environmental Lucas Poles, for example, who is he's a manager within the County Health Department for Environmental Matters. He didn't want to give, for example, an exact level, because he was just like, there's nuances to what this really means when you're talking about milligrams and water and, you know, what we mean by contamination. I feel like there was a lot of reference to the state health department to maybe try and share some of the responsibility as to who's determining what is and isn't safe and what the protocols are. And this is, of course, an interview that was only a couple months after the pipes had burst, but then also very quickly when the public became aware as well. So I think they were still trying to figure out how much to share and what the protocol from the state was going to be, because that hadn't come down yet.
Obviously, a contamination of this kind is not good. I got to thinking about the amount of time that people end up spending at the jail. Mm-hmm. Some people might just be in overnight, and some people end up staying for much longer periods of time. Do you have a sense of the average length of stay at the jail and how long people might be relying on this water system?
Yes, because of other stories that I've done related to the jail, not necessarily this one, I was told by the sheriff that the average stay, or I'm sorry, the Sheriff Richard Fuller at Kalamazoo County Sheriff's Administration Office, that the, or he confirmed what the lieutenant at the time was telling me as well, and that was the average is rising because of the amount of people who are being held in the jail who are awaiting the trial for the felony charges that they are facing.
There are some backups in the Kalamazoo court system.
Exactly. Yeah. And so because of that reason, people are staying at the jail longer than what the jail was built to handle. Also, I want to raise a project out of NYU that is the Jail Data Initiative that collects, that scrapes the data of local jails. And they do have a profile for Kalamazoo County. And that is also showing over time, from COVID till now is what it compares. There is a raise in the percentage of how long people are staying. So before you've got days and months, and now there are more people who are staying for more than 365 days. So it's not, it's rising for different reasons. But ultimately, regardless of how long someone's in this jail, the idea that they don't have access to clean water, of course, is shocking.
Do you have any questions remaining in your mind? I mean, there is the issue of a long-term fix, but are you planning any follow-up stories on this? Questions about what's happened so far or what will happen next?
Yes, I have plenty of follow-up stories I'd like to do. We are a small newsroom over at Now Kalamazoo, and I'm sure all the journalists are laughing as I say that because we're all a little strapped. First of all, just continuing to follow the solution, you know, this water filtration system and the solutions to get clean water in the jail, because it's still not being used for drinking. It was still being used for cooking and hygiene last I checked. So I still want to follow how it's resolved. The main thing for me that this spotlighted is the conditions at the jail and the ability the folks being held there have to speak up for and advocate for what they need. So, for example, as it relates to the water, according to the Sheriff's Administration, no one's ailments have come as a result of the water. These bumps, this nausea, the puking of blood, the things that I have quoted the men saying that they've experienced.
So the Sheriff's Department has said
that's not the case.
That's not the water.
However, yeah. Regardless of what the source is, what's clear is the men that I spoke to don't feel as if they have the ability to get the medical attention that they seek, and the transparency that they seek as to what exactly is wrong with them then and what may be the result of the ailments that they are saying, regardless of if it's the water or not I have. So, for example, you've got men telling me that when they wanted to be seen by nurses, they had to get a hold of what's called a kite. A kite is essentially what allows you to talk back and forth between administration and, you know, or the medical administration and you who are, you know, in the cell. You can't just walk freely to go get what you need. And that it would even take days for some folks to get that kite to be able to express that they needed to be seen by a medical examiner. And then whether or not that is taken seriously, and then even the steps after if you are seen and how you're able to get access to your health documents, that is all something that they just don't have the autonomy to control. And so it's clear that there's not, it's clear that there is a flaw in the system where folks feel like their rights are being infringed upon.
Christanity May is the managing editor of Now Kalamazoo, and you can read her stories about water quality at Kalamazoo's County Jail at the website nowkalamazoo.org. Christanity, thank you so much for your work and for talking to us about this.
Mm-hmm, of course. Thank you for having me.
We've got to take a quick break right now, and we've got something special coming up next for you from the On Hand podcast. It's all about your favorite Great Lakes pastime, hunting for cool rocks. Am I right?
You can find Petoskey's. I've got friends that have horses north of town, and they kick them out of the pasture all the time. They're a lot easier to see wet, so the shoreline is basically where you're going to go. But you can find them on gravel roads. You can find them in rock pits. They're all over the place. Once you get an eye for them, you'll see them a lot more.
If you've ever wondered about where Petoskey stones come from and how to find them, we've got the goods for you. But we also know that Michiganders love a cool rock, and that runs deep. We want to hear from you about your rock hunting adventures. Is there a rock that you've been searching for forever and you finally found it? What is your white whale of rock hounding? Did you grow up combing beaches with your favorite grandparent? Do you have a hidden secret beach that you won't let anybody know about because it's just got the best rocks? Whatever it is, we want to hear your story, and you can email it to us at onhand@michiganpublic.org. Or you can go to the On Hand page at michiganpublic.org and look for the submission form. Coming up next, that episode of On Hand, all about Petoskey stones. You're with Stateside.
This is On Hand, a production of Stateside. It's a place where we answer all your questions about our unique state. I'm April Baer.
My name is Clary Frederick, and I currently live in Linden, Michigan. My question is, are Petoskey stones only found in Petoskey, Michigan, or are they found anywhere else?
Have you ever been walking around on a Michigan beach and found a stone with a hexagonal pattern, almost like a honeycomb? That, my friend, is a Petoskey stone, the state stone of Michigan. And for many a Michigander, Petoskeys are way more than just a cool-looking rock. They're a physical reminder of happy memories of Michigan summers past.
We love Petoskey. I've been going up there as a child first camping, and then we brought our children up there camping, who are now full-grown adults. And of course, when I was a child, loved finding Petoskey stones. And even as an adult, loved to find Petoskey stones.
This is On Hand. I'm April Baer. Today, roll up your pant legs. We're going rock hounding. We'll talk all about how and where to find Petoskey stones and what these unique rocks can tell us about the history of our state. On Hand producer April Van Buren is going to be our guide for this episode. Hello, April.
Hi, April.
So what have you been able to find out for Clary? Can we find Petoskey stones outside of Petoskey?
Well, I'm going to make this real short for you. The answer is yes.
That's it. Episode over.
Yep, that's it.
Okay, this is On Hand, and
okay,
I'm April.
Okay. Wait. Maybe I'm just kidding. The short answer is that yes, you can find Petoskey stones in places that are not the northern Michigan town of Petoskey. You can find them across the state, actually, and into some of the other Great Lakes states like Indiana and Wisconsin, like this one I found in Lake Huron.
Oh, that's a nice specimen.
Thank you. But even knowing that, I still had a lot of questions about Petoskey stones. Like, where did they come from? How do you find them?
And, I mean, why do they look like a honeycomb?
Exactly. So I tracked down someone who could answer those questions for us, and who also happens to be an excellent rock hound himself.
There's been days that the next day you definitely know that you were rock hunting the day before. hours.
You feel it in your back?
You feel it everywhere.
That is Scott Wack. He and his wife, Jennifer, literally wrote the book on finding Petoskey stones and other rocks around the Great Lakes. And that book is called Rock Hounding, A Beginner's Guide to Rock Hunting Around Lake Michigan. Scott and Jennifer are also co-owners of Northport Trading Post, which is this super cute family-run gift shop on the Leelanau Peninsula.
How are you guys?
Hi, good.
Come on in.
I'm looking for Scott.
You got it right here.
Okay, hi, I'm April.
April and...
Ronia.
Very nice to meet you.
The store is filled with their rock-hounding finds, including lots and lots of Petoskey's, obviously. There's jewelry made out of beach finds, coasters, wine toppers, and of course, plenty of cool rocks.
I mean, it sounds like Scott and Jennifer don't just love collecting rocks. They've built a whole business out of this.
Yep, and they did it all for love.
I took Scott right out of the city. We met in D.C. area, so I told him we had to get married up here in Northport because it was so beautiful in Rock Hunt.
I said, okay, and now here we are 30-some years later and we own a rock shop.
So where do they find rocks for the shop?
So they find them all over the place, but they do have a few favorite spots around the Leelanau Peninsula. And fellow on-hand producer Ronia Cabinsug and I were lucky enough to catch Scott and Jennifer and their son Alden on their day off during what is a very busy summer tourist season. So they took us out to the beach and we went rock hounding.
We are at Peterson Park. This is about a 250-foot bluff overlooking Lake Michigan. My grandfather actually helped build the original steps coming down to the beach.
Wow.
So my family's been coming here for a very long time.
It's a lot of fun to really get out on the shoreline and find stones like that. Petoskey's being 360 million years old, you're probably the first person, if you find a Petoskey, to touch that Petoskey in 360 million years.
So how did it go? Was it like a Petoskey-palooza?
I am going to be honest, it was a little bit harder than I was expecting. Well, for me at least. Gosh, Jennifer, I don't know how you zeroed in on these. Okay, now I see something interesting happening here, but I don't think it's Petoskey. No. False flag.
Oh, she's going after something. Okay. Let's see.
No. Oh, man, I thought I'd found one. I never did quite get my eye trained to pick out a Petoskey stone the way that Jennifer and Scott can, but with a little bit, or maybe quite a bit of help, I did manage to score a few.
All right, we
got a test coming up.
Pop quiz. It's a little
one. Okay, it's a little one in this general area. All right, April, focus.
Okay.
Ooh.
The tiny
yes!
One?
Yay! Oh, wait, this one's so cute. It's a baby.
All right, so you are not yet an expert Petoskey stone hunter, but did you get some good tips for looking for them?
I did. So Jennifer told me it is so much easier to see a Petoskey stone pattern when it is wet.
For all my life that I have been hunting rocks on the beaches, there's only been one beach that I have found them in the sand, dry.
So looking right at the water's edge is a good technique, or in that shallow water close to shore. And with Petoskey stones in particular, you want to keep your eye out for circle patterns.
Yeah, we're definitely looking for a gray rock. This one is really, really hard to see the circles, but what I like to look for is like a circle pattern. This looks suspicious to me.
Even if they don't look like that classic Petoskey stone honeycomb at first, they might reveal themselves in the polishing process. Like this one we polished up at the shop.
Stone all the way around. I want you to make that texture all the way around, just on that top and around the sides a little bit.
Oh, that came out really nice.
But you can see on the back what it looked like before.
Oh.
It's just kind of a light gray rock with a rough surface is what it looks like to me.
I don't know if I would have pegged that for a Petoskey if I saw it on a beach. But on the other side, the pattern looks so clear and beautiful, all polished up.
Yeah, I definitely did not find this one. This was a Jennifer find. So even if you, like me, have a hard time finding Petoskey stones, rock hounding is also just about picking up things you like the look of.
You don't really have to develop an eye. It's whatever you find cool. You know, if it looks good, it's going in my pocket. Really, everybody sees it a little bit differently.
And the most important lesson I took away from spending time with the wax is that the rocks you find along the beach, they all tell a story. And learning about those stories behind your favorite finds is part of the fun of it all.
Petoskeys aren't just a cool-looking rock. They're also a record of our state's ancient history. To learn more about that, we're going to return now to Scott Wack. Scott, hi. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Can we start with the basics? What is a Petoskey stone?
A Petoskey stone is a 350-million-year-old fossilized coral. It came from the Devonian time of period, and back in that time, before all the tectonic plates were shifted, we landed a little bit closer to the equator, and Michigan was under a shallow seawater. So they are not freshwater; they're saltwater corals, and they're pretty neat. They're pretty neat. You can still find their cousins, or distant cousins, down in Florida, but no longer up here. They're all along the beaches.
What gives them that distinctive look?
The shape of the coral itself. If you can think of a coral that you've seen from Florida, it's very similar. Each eye represents a part of that organism that took in microorganisms and fed that way. So if you could think about a coral from Florida, that's what a Petoskey would have looked like back then.
Wow.
Just filled with limestone and sediment and fossilized.
Fossilized. Okay, so you're saying that what we now see as a Petoskey stone was once living creatures?
Absolutely, 100%. When the glaciers pushed across Michigan, they pushed southeast across Michigan, which dropped them from the Grand Traverse strata all the way across Michigan to the southeast. So the further south you go, the less you're going to get. Petoskey and Northport happen to be in that line of the full push. It's an amazing, and there's lots of different corals out there as well, not just the Petoskey stone, but you've got chain coral, horn coral, honeycomb coral, favosites, charlevoix stones, lots of different corals up in the area.
Scott, can you tell us a little bit about the best places to look for them? I mean, I always assumed that Petoskey was my best shot, but is there a range for Petoskey stones?
So the Grand Traverse strata was above us to the north, but lower than Superior. So you're not going to find a lot of fossils up in Superior, but you can find Petoskeys. I've got friends that have horses north of town, and they kick them out of the pasture all the time. They're a lot easier to see wet, so the shoreline is basically where you're going to go. But you can find them on gravel roads. You can find them in rock pits. They're all over the place. Oh. Once you get an eye for them, you'll see them a lot more.
Oh, wow. I know you said Lake Superior is not a place to go looking for Petoskey stones, but have you ever heard of anybody finding them in Lake Huron or Lake Erie maybe?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's some really nice ones that come out of Lake Huron. I've even had people come in from Indiana that have pushed it down. Now, granted, that's a little far, and that's probably the exception. They haven't been much further than that. But really anywhere, if you look at the state of Michigan at the back of your hand and you go from the upper left to the lower right, that's kind of the line that the glaciers pushed. So the further out from that line, you're going to be less likely to find them.
Scott, I know that your knowledge of fossils goes way beyond the Petoskey stone. What other types of fossils are commonly found along the shores of our lakes?
So my favorite coral is the chain coral. Chain corals, and each coral has a specific look to it. You know, you've got chain corals that have a chain link-like look on the outside of the stone that goes around the stone. You've got Syringopora, which is another type of branch coral. There's horn corals. There's, like I said earlier, chain corals. There's so many different kinds of corals that all came from around that time period. And it really depends on how deep the rabbit hole you want to go with, you know, these are 360 million year old fossils and you're finding one on the beach, you're the first one to touch it.
Do you mind telling the story about how you got into it?
Sure. So I am from the Washington, D.C. area, Rockville, Germantown area, and I met my now wife down in that area. She said that she wanted to move to Northport and collect rocks and get married. I said, okay. And we moved up here, and in 99, we went to the family's property, and her grandfather had polished stones back in the early 70s. And when he passed in the mid-70s, no one had opened up his little rock shop that he had on the family property. And once we opened that up, we saw work that he had finished, things that he hadn't finished, all his smocks, all his equipment out there, and a whole lot of Petoskeys. We figured, well, we might as well learn how to use this stuff and have some fun doing it. So we learned how to do it through the TC Rockhounds. had some held some classes, and we went down, and for a long time we did Christmas craft shows and art fairs and farmers markets and stuff. I'm a residential builder. My wife used to be a nurse, and that was kind of our side gig then. And then in 2020, we decided to open up a rock shop, and here we are.
I love the fact that when this started, you were doing it for love.
Oh, it's always for love. I didn't stop doing it for love. I truly love it. It's arts and crafts every day.
That's awesome. Do you feel like the Petoskey Stone is sort of a gateway rock for people who are just starting to get curious about what they can find?
Absolutely, 100%. Because the Petoskey Stone is a famous stone. You know, it's the famous coral that when you go to Michigan, you think of Petoskey. Once you start with Petoskey, the other amount of different stones that are up here will catch you. The colors, the greens, the reds, the yellows, they will catch you. And absolutely 100%, I do agree with that.
Let's say I found my first Petoskey stone. What should I look for next to expand my Great Lakes collection? Is the chain coral the obvious next step, or is there something a little more common?
If it looks cool, pick it up. So I may go out one day and I may be looking for, let's say I need green rocks. I won't see any green rocks. If I'm looking for it, I'll never find it. When you come across it, you'll know it.
I absolutely love that. That what you said, if it looks cool, pick it up. That was absolutely my dad's advice for being out and around and looking for rocks.
And everybody's going to see something a little different, you know. I can be walking behind some people on the beach, and they'll walk right past something because their eyes aren't trained or they're not able to see. They're looking for something else. I might be looking for something else. So I always look behind people that are walking in front of me because they always miss something.
I have to confess, I guess I've just spent too much time in our national parks. I feel like when I'm out and I see a cool rock, at this point in my life, I'm less likely to pick it up because I'm worried that somehow at some point all the cool rocks will have been picked up by people just like me. Have you found that over time it's getting harder to find the Petoskey stones and the chain corals that dazzled you when you were just starting out?
Not at all. And let me just say something really quick. Just because you brought up a national park, you cannot collect stones from a national park.
Right. So if you're at Sleeping Bear.
Just to make sure that your listeners understand that. Don't pick them up.
Yeah. If you're at Sleeping Bear Dunes.
Yeah. Don't pick up those rocks. Don't pick up those rocks. But we get very particular on what we pick up nowadays. We want to make sure that everyone is able to see it, but there is no shortage of rocks. We live on a rock. There will always be rocks here.
That's very good to hear.
Kind of reassuring, huh?
Right, totally. Are there any etiquette rules when it comes to rock hounding?
Yes and no. I mean, it's really personal preference. You know, if I'm walking on the beach and I see somebody that's walking on it and they're ahead of me and I want to pass, I'm not going to jump in right with them and you know, get right on top of them. I'll give them some space so they have some chance to look. There is a public trust around the state of Michigan that you can walk around the whole state of Michigan without being unencumbered. As long as you don't camp in front of someone's house, you can actually go anywhere you want where there's a beach, as long as you don't park your stuff in somebody's house. And always be respectful. I usually end up trying to pick up trash if I see trash. You know, it's just common sense things that we want to preserve for the next group of rock hounds.
Thanks so much to Scott and Jennifer Wack for giving us this crash course in rock hounding. If you're up on the Leelanau Peninsula, you can find the Wacks at their rock shop. It's the Northport Trading Post. If you have your own rock hunting story, we want to hear about it. Maybe that white whale rock you've been searching for forever and finally found? Or do you have a funny or meaningful memory about searching for rocks on Great Lakes beaches with someone you love? Maybe you even proposed to your spouse with a Petoskey stone ring. Whatever it is, we want to hear your story. You can email us. The address is onhand@michiganpublic.org. Or go to the onhand page at michiganpublic.org and just look for the submission form. It's very easy to use. That wraps it up for Stateside for today. Our show's producers are Mike Blank, Ronia Cabansag, Michelle Jokishpolo, and April Van Buren. Our senior producer is Mercedes Mejia, and the executive producer of Stateside is Laura Weber Davis. Our interns are Nicholas Alumkal, Isabella Jacob, Jaden Jefferson, and Yena Vasise. Stateside's a production of Michigan Public. You can find out more at michiganpublic.org. We're a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. It's good to have you with us today. See you tomorrow. Stay safe out there.